It's 8:12 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Board of Education met yesterday in a studio with a recap of some of the issues discussed. I have school board member Aaron Grady, along with the superintendent of schools, Jill Gilday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the board discussed the changes of the school fee statute, spent a long time discussing that. Business Administrator Todd Hauber explaining that each school district now has to have precise waiver policies in place. The legislature very focused on policies that don't stigmatize students and that maintain privacy. Todd says there's now a requirement that each district has a school fee policy. So didn't we do this already last year?
We actually did. We're a little bit ahead of the curve here in Park City, which we're proud of. And we're very proud of the action the board and the community has taken in eradicating or removing all academic fees well ahead of that legislation.
So this Park City School District's policy is already in compliance then? Yeah.
Yes.
The school board eliminated the fees, though, to the tune of nearly $800,000, which has got to be made up somewhere. So is the legislature then going to fund that?
Wouldn't that be wonderful? I think part of this discussion has been with the weighted pupil unit. This is the way that districts are planning for this as we go forward.
Okay. And then what about textbook fees?
Same thing, right? There are none. There are no textbook fees for our students.
Here in Park City.
Here in Park City.
All right. And then what's the process that we currently use to waive extracurricular fees? Because these still must be paid.
Right. There has always been a fee waiver policy for students and families who qualify for free and reduced lunch. And that happens fairly seamlessly with the families who are in need.
So the legislature, as I understand it, asking each school board to determine what a maximum aggregate fee per student should be for extracurricular fees. This takes into consideration that a student may want to participate in many activities that could run into thousands of dollars. So, Aaron, how will the board make that determination?
Well, I think right now that's kind of what the conversation started last night. There is public comment on this, so we're looking for the public to come in and discuss it with us as well. But, you know, I think it was interesting. Todd last night said there's districts that are going anywhere between $3,000 and $4,000 on a cap all the way up to, I believe, $15,000 on a cap. So I guess right now we're just kind of, as board, taking in all that information, getting some understanding. We asked Todd to bring us back some more data on where our students are standing financially with some things and where the asks are happening so that we can make the best decision for our community.
All right. During the budget discussion, we heard that the land trust funds were discussed, and it seems there's an issue with spending those funds in the school year. Again, Todd mentioning that we had a surplus of $62,000. Is that money that was supposed to be spent before this year?
Yes. So with some leadership transition over the past few years, this is a complex process. And what happens is if people don't spend their money, we sometimes in the late spring receive an additional allocation. Mm-hmm. So if money comes in late, sometimes it's hard to expend it within that same fiscal year. So our money was actually encumbered, but all of the invoices and things hadn't come in.
So what do you mean the money was encumbered?
That there were plans for it. So there was a full plan to spend all of it. And then maybe the teachers finished writing their curriculum the very end of June. They put their invoice in July 1st. That becomes the new year.
So it's not like it wasn't spent. It
Correct.
Just didn't leave the fund.
Correct. It was a carryover.
Okay. Right. So there's no penalty or anything for...
Just a carryover, but it's just an accounting issue then, but that's why the clarification was needed.
Okay. So it's the community councils at each of the schools then that decide how that money's going to be spent?
Yes, and then they propose that to the board every year. We get the proposals. I think probably we'll see them in the next upcoming months.
All right. School board member Andrew Kaplan asked that the issue be brought up more on a monthly basis so that we don't see this problem happening again.
So I think that is for the specific school that we're talking about. If I'm correct, it's the high school. And we just want to make sure that we as board members are fiscally or fiduciarily responsible for this. And we just want to make sure that we stay on top of it as well as the councils.
Okay. Let's see. You heard from Chief Operating Officer Mike Tanna, who gave an update on the security measures specifically at the high school, as well as the area between Treasure Mountain and the high school. So we've got all of the vestibules complete at the high school?
Yes. Very exciting.
Okay. What does it look like for visitors now? They all get funneled into the office?
Right. You come in through the right side and you check in with the secretary who's at the front. We run your ID, your driver's license or your state ID, which runs against several federal databases just to make sure everything is A-OK. It also runs against our local student information system. If there's a special ruling from a court system on who's allowed to pick up a student or drop off a student. So this helps us stay in compliance with that local paperwork as well. So this flashes up on the secretary's screen so that she knows if a student can be released or not to that particular individual. So it helps with drop off, pick up, as well as keeping an inventory of who's in the school in case there was ever an emergency.
And how have we dealt with the many doors to access the high school? Are those all now locked?
We work really hard. You know, it's so hard. Schools are designed really to be community centers. They're designed to be welcoming. They're designed to have people in and out. And so now we're living in a new world with some new challenges. So, yes, you know, perimeter doors around the backside or around the athletic side of the building are locked or closed. And we funnel students through the front and the side near Eccles Theater.
Okay. And we've got a couple of hundred, I think 200 kids a day transitioning between Treasure Mountain and the high school. How are we keeping those kids safe?
Right. So the kids do transverse. So the good news is they get a healthy walk in between some of the periods. They have about a 10-minute block there where they can do that quick pace walk. There's not a lot of time for dallying to get back and forth. Some kids take a bike, some kids take a scooter, some kids jog, some parents come and actually transport kids in between periods on a very regular basis. It's an every other day schedule, you know, red white schedule. So yeah, we have a lot of ways that kids go back and forth. But the good news about that is as we look to the high school and transitioning kids there, we already know that we can handle at least 200 more kids, and it's really 400 who are moving over.
Right.
So that's good news.
But again, I mean, is there some armed guard that travels with the kids? Or?
We actually, you know, as you know, we do have school resource officers as well as police frequently circulating campus. We have cameras, line view between the two schools. So I feel it's a very safe, you know, area to walk in. It's protected. There's fencing on both sides. There's our fields. So a very clear line of sight for us. I think my bigger concern is sometimes wildlife, which runs through.
Let's see. Academic Officer Amy Hunt updated you with letting you know that testing time coming up in April. As we recall, all of these schools across the state had trouble with the new RISE testing program. So what's changing this year?
Right. Well, the state shifted its deployment of the assessment. So we think the questions are going to be similar to what our kids have seen before. But obviously, they're trying to improve a statewide assessment system so that it runs smoothly. Fortunately, up here in Park City last year, we had some interruptions, mostly at Treasure Mountain. You know, those kids got disrupted in their testing cycles. But for the most part, our elementaries ran pretty smoothly, and we were pretty happy with the results. Our schools showed great gains, and we're really proud of their accomplishments.
So you feel like you have good data from that?
Well, you know, we have to take a multi-year approach when we look at this. It's so hard when the vendor changes every few years to establish a longitudinal, you know, efficacy, but that's obviously what we're working towards. But we felt good about it. We didn't, you know, we felt that the numbers made sense. You know, they didn't go so far up or so far down that we had questions.
Amy Hunt also spoke about the process, making the process more meaningful so that we could build more participation, again, because it's kind of an opt-in thing. What is the participation rate that we currently have in the district?
You know, each school is a little bit different, but it's so important. Even though I know there's a fear of over-testing, truly testing is less than 2% of our school calendar. So really, we've kept it minimal. We are not over-testing the kids, but there is that fear of that high-stakes environment. I think what we have to remind our community of is the kids will have high stakes college entrance exams, whether that's called the ACT or the SAT. This is great practice for them. It gives us that data point to see how they're growing at a different point of the year. So, you know, I think it's important for people to understand it's not horrific to have a student sit and take a test. It's really okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, are you getting that message out to parents?
We do. Just the way we try to communicate with our parents on lots of things, emails, newsletters, you know, just reminders that the participation rate is helpful for our national standing, our national ranking.
Yeah. Well, and especially when we have, you know, lower participation, then the results really are skewed. I mean, so it, again, back to the question, is it good data if we've only got...
Right. When you look at, you have to realize it's what I call autopsy data. You're always looking at it in the rears. I mean, we're looking at, just like we when we do our SHARP survey, it's the spring before. And then by the time they analyze all the data, it's sometimes 6 months later. So you're really not changing a child's instruction because of that assessment. It's really measuring the system, the instructional system. And is it designed to generate growth overall in our kids?
Okay. So again, that's coming up. Parents, if you're listening, you know, please send your kids to school. After all of the months of engagement, the master planning process, moving ahead into the implementation phase, there have been several meetings with the bond architects. It sounds like some of these we'll see some more specifics coming in March that will outline the cost for the master planning options. The biggest priority to get the ninth grade back into the high school. So at this March meeting, will there be a final dollar figure that is associated with that initiative?
It will not be a final dollar figure yet because we have to direct the architect as to what our preferred option is. So we will have ranges of several options still, and then it will be up to the community and the board to make that, put feedback in and share that insight with us so that the board can make the best decision. We're definitely looking at a phased, it won't be a 1 year only. You know, this is something that we're looking at 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, even a 30-year horizon to give this community a really good idea as to what it can do to keep its schools modern, you know, up to date, sustainable, great energy package, you know, how to save money that way. So they're really looking at all aspects of the facilities.
So is one of those aspects then looking into moving the high school out into the Snyderville Basin? Because I think, as you mentioned, you know, we've got 30% of the high school population in town, 70% of it living in the Snyderville Basin.
You know, I think if we didn't ask the architect to at least to do a quick pencil sketch on that, we would be missing an opportunity. So, of course, I think we will want to weigh that out as a community.
And then also, parents will actually be emailed a link this evening. And we're asking community members for feedback for the architects. So, and community members can also find it on our homepage later today. So we're looking for feedback to give to the architects before they come and meet with us in the March with
specifically about the high school and the ninth grade, or just everything?
Overall. So this is one simple question. This is a really fun platform that I hope our community and our staff will engage in and enjoy. It's called Thought Exchange. What happens is we will put out the thought. What is the most important thing this architecture team needs to know? What's our key priority as we move forward? People can put in one answer, three answers, five answers. You put what your answer is, and then if you want to, a little rationale as to why. Then you will receive an email back that says, hey, you participated in this question. Would you like to see how other people answered? And would you like to rate the different responses that have come in? And then we will be able to give the architect that long list with starred priorities from our community. It's a really nice way to equalize participation from individuals, as well as really surface top priorities for our community.
All right. So do we have some kind of timeline on in terms of the what the architects, information the architects provide?
You know, they have been doing amazing work. We have allowed them these first six meetings to really just work internally to hear from the staff, to hear from the administrators, to make sure they clearly understand everything that came out of the last process. And they have been doing a phenomenal job internally. I've been really pleased. Every week they come back with it, you know, iterations and ideas and drafts and cost parameters, escalations, all the things we will need to consider. So they're helping to educate us about this is, you know, what we think we're hearing and what we're reading. Is it accurate? So they are really doing a great job listening and giving us back that information. So we're going to be really excited to have the board see some of these ideas in March, talk about them with the community in March and April, and then come to some resolution and direction later this spring.
So what is that meeting, that March meeting?
March 17th. And the way I know that is because it's St. Patrick's Day and my husband's 100% Irish.
Okay. Let's see. The legislature passed a resolution encouraging school districts to adopt later start times. Mike Tanner telling the school board that would cost an additional $650,000 a year to operate the buses and another $1.6 million to purchase more of the buses. So, I mean, Aaron, as you may recall, the board was ready years ago to pull the cord on later start times. We have, of course, experts in science saying that it's critical for the developing adolescents to get more sleep. Are we dragging our feet on this?
You know, I think right now it's something that we have never stopped the conversation with. It's something we've always included as part of our master planning and have continued to talk about it. So it is something that is built in with our master planning and talking of what that future is going to look like and as we move forward. So, and as I believe, I mean, we're kind of in an interesting spot here, right, with our traffic patterns across Kearns with ski. So yeah, we know like financially that there are definitely some things, but again, it's something that we haven't ever lost sight of, and it is something that we have been including in our master planning moving forward.
Okay, so we have checked in with the community's interests on this.
Something that is unique to Utah and I think really helps this conversation is we have something here in Utah called parent release. I don't know if you've heard of parent release. Okay. I had not heard of it. My daughter learned about it within the first 3 days of her being here at Park City High School last year. So it's something that's well known among the student community. And this means that you can take a block of a period off as a family. You can decide if you're going to do a homeschool option, an accelerated training if you're an athlete, an online course. You know, there are so many different ways that kids can access learning right now. It's such an exciting time, I think. And so we do have about 33% of the kids at the high school who do take advantage of this, where it might be early, you know, late start for them, or it might be a late or an early out if they're an athlete. Sometimes they will take that to not miss instructional time at the end of the day if they're traveling to their different competitions in their season. So this can change my semester. Whether they take first or fourth, my daughter has tried both, and has, you know, it does help with this. If you know your child really needs that sleep in the morning, you as a family can meet with that high school counselor and make that decision for your family, which is very helpful.
Yeah, and if you were to do that, I mean, would it affect your finishing on time?
No, it does not, because we have more blocks than credits that are required.
Okay. Real quick, Mary Krista Smith from Communities at Care gave an update on the SHARP survey. Any comments on the findings there that you wanted to?
Well, first off, I just say thank you to Mary Krista, her team. They are doing such an amazing job in the community. So I think the board overwhelmingly just can't thank them enough. I think if anybody was at the meeting or listened to the meeting, the board was a tad bit shocked by some of the data coming in. But again, it's just good information to have, and we can't thank them enough for their partnership.
Their preventative work is really a huge support for our entire county, not just Park City, so that is amazing. We have very low participation rate in that particular survey, so it is really hard to generalize, but I do believe if we look at the state trends, that is very helpful for our prevention planning. And, you know, we look at these kinds of things, you know, kids experimenting, right, with alcohol or drugs, and we just know it's a community education need that we have to keep letting parents know.
Yeah,
you know.
Anything specifically though that concerns you? I mean, it sounds like we're gonna figure out the vaping issue, right, with monitors and things like that. And
right, but again, it's education for the kids. They don't realize that they're becoming addicted to nicotine the same way they would if they were smokers. So it's something that it really takes health education, which is embedded in our programs as young as fifth grade. We're trying to teach the kids not to inhale something you don't know. But it's health and well-being. It's a huge community topic and really important, and I think we all need to continue that conversation.
Okay. Superintendent Gilday, Aaron Grady, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
It's 8:32. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Council is meeting tomorrow, the first time since their annual retreat 2 weeks ago. Park City Manager Matt Dias joins us now with a preview of that. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So how did the retreat grow from your perspective as city manager?
Well, it was obviously my first retreat as the city manager, and I think the most informative part was we had some really wonderful information from a year's worth of visioning. to dig deep. And we spent probably an hour to maybe 2 hours on topical areas coming out of the visioning that will be shared with the community at our State of the City next week. And, you know, I guess the scary part and the exciting part was just the level of aggressiveness that I think council wants to take on these pillars that we've been formulating about local tourism and equity and transportation and housing and the thrust of their desire to really move the needle on these issues, and then a willingness to provide more resources to make progress in these areas, and knowing that with our existing resources, we'll likely need more to really move the needle.
Yeah, and I guess that's, rather than looking specifically at the critical priorities, it's felt like the council spent more time philosophizing about the pillars, as you mentioned, through the visioning process. So was anything accomplished?
It was, indeed. Again, I think that, you know, it was no surprise that the visioning was somewhat of a reaffirmation of the existing critical community priorities. I don't think anyone in this community walks around here and doesn't understand sort of the compression points and where the sensitivities lie. But I think the real diagnostic was the boldness that we feel in the community, the desire in the community to move the needle, to be aggressive, to pilot programs, to explore, to be willing to fail in certain areas. And so what it really crystallized for us as sort of the administrative side of the house is that we're going to have to come back with some really rigorous implementation plans and allow City Council to prioritize in housing, in transportation, in affordability, in equity, what they hope to achieve. And there will be constraints. There will be cost constraints. There will be time constraints. There will be labor constraints. And if they're going to move the needle, we may need to make budget adjustments. We're really going to have to take a step back if we're going to accelerate our goals.
Well, and I guess that's where I was confused, because I think it was brought up during the retreat. I mean, when we're talking about boldness, is it about keeping Park City, or is it about creating a bedroom community where everybody can afford to live here?
Yeah, no, I never heard that notion, that it's a bedroom community that everyone can afford to live here. And, you know, by and large, we sort of moved away from that keeping Park City, because I think at least the sentiment I felt was that was very sort of protectionist and wasn't enough forward-looking and forward-thinking. And so this council, and through this visioning process, what I think we've heard from the community is there are some sacrosanct issues that we need to work on and be bold and be rigorous and apply resources. And we have great resources to bring to bear. But in doing so, we always have to do that with a sentiment towards the local kind of economy and the fabric of what makes Park City unique, our historic covenants, this ability to be able to come here and work here, the rental economy. And so it's a balancing act. It's obviously going to be a tightrope walk. But now we're going to move to sort of my phase in the process. As we spent a year working with the community and visioning, council has sort of reaffirmed these pillars and these areas that we're going to focus on. And the city administration and staff working with community partners is now going to start working on implementation plans.
So what is at the top of your implementation to-do list?
Well, numero uno, which was identified by City Council in their policy direction, was transportation. But we have 5 pillars now that will be breaking off into groups and making implementation plans under each pillar, and then returning to City Council and having them prioritize, you know, what types of programs we're going to run in the transportation area in the next 3 to 5 years. What types of programs are we going to run in the housing quadrant in the next 3 to 5 years? And what resources can we bring to bear? And some of those may be very, very costly and expensive, and some of them may not. But we will be identifying them and working with stakeholders.
Yeah. So this polling that you guys did during the visioning process there, you know, when you have 80 people in the audience and we've got 34% of them saying, you know, that they favor more taxes for affordable housing, we're talking about 31 people out of a town of 8,000. How, I mean, is this driving decisions here? I mean, I find that really interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
that it's like some mandate that, you know, that we go out and, you know, build more affordable housing or make Main Street a pedestrian walkway.
Yeah, and I guess I don't know if I would use the word mandate or if I would sort of diminish the value of a year-long process by one meeting. We spent hundreds of hours in people's living rooms, working with associations all over town, business associations, HOAs. And we did have a few sort of pinnacle meetings where we had 80 or 150, 200 people in the room. And we did some rapid polling just to kind of get the sense of the room and some immediate feedback. But the action items and the information coming out of the visioning process, I don't want to diminish. We spent over a year, again, moving into people's living rooms, working with every association in town from lodging to the chamber to HPCA, and we're very, very proud of it. And so I think it would be a misnomer to think that 31 people are somehow guiding the city. However, I should
specifically
caveat.
On increasing taxes, I guess, is what I was getting at.
Well, yeah, and so we've heard a lot of that throughout the visioning process when we met with different groups. And so I think that would be a misnomer. But again, we're very, very proud of the process. And, you know, we do want people to show up, though. And I think if you want your voice heard, you know, we go to great efforts to be very transparent, to use social media, to use our notification systems, to make sure that people know when we're having these meetings. And we were very encouraged by the turnout.
The council will be considering some proposed changes to the Kimball Arts Festival, including removing admission fees for everyone, not just Summit County residents like we did last year, and expanding the festival footprint to more of Main Street. Both changes could really increase festival attendance. So how is the city planning to mitigate those impacts on residents?
Well, you couldn't have said it better. The Free the Fest sort of is a very noble idea, and I think we're at least council has intimated that they're excited about it. And I think staff is as well in terms of potentially eliminating admission to the festival. And then by doing so, there will obviously be impacts that you've noted about expanded footprint. And for the city, that means additional trash and recycling and pedestrian management and transit and public safety. And so it's a balancing act. And ultimately, that's going to be a concern for a question for city council about whether they intend to approve this change. That technically the Kimball Art Fest contract isn't up for renewal until 2021. So this would be sort of a mid-contract substantial change. But there are some really noble elements that we're interested in. However, we are concerned with sort of being overrun by some of the impacts.
Yeah. Is this the Kimball's plan? I mean, is that what they're presenting to you to go to Free the Fest?
That's correct.
Because this is their biggest fundraiser, and they have relied on the entrance fees as a way to support their mission.
Yeah, that's correct. And so, I don't want to speak for them, obviously, but their sort of economic model or their fundraising plan has accommodated for this, and this is part of it. And I think they think that if they can grow attendance and some additional sponsorships, that they can make up for those attendance receipts, and by doing so, open the festival to more people. And again, that's a very noble idea, and we're encouraged by it, we're excited by it. But on our end of the ledger, you know, at the end of the day, we're the ones that have to clean the streets and put out the safety bollards and staff it with police and pedestrian management. And we want to make sure that we don't get overrun by the impacts of more growth and more activation and more intensity. So again, you're going to see, city council and staff and the applicant sort of walk this dance of, you know, worrying about neighborhood impacts and worrying about intensity of events, yet wanting that vibrancy and that quality of life.
So the city already waives fees for city services during the Arts Festival. What kind of increased fees would you anticipate from these changes?
Well, it's going to run the range, and right now we have up to an $180,000 limit in our fee waiver limit, and we do believe that this may exceed that capacity, and that's another reason that we're coming back before council, because that would be a council decision that they would have to authorize, and it really is based on the level of attendance that we will ultimately see. We don't know what that is. Right now, I think Kimball expects a 10% increase. Some of our estimates are at the 20 and 30% range, and if we reach 20 and 30% increase in attendance, that will bounce that $180,000 fee limit.
City's launching a new website. How will this be more friendly to the public?
Well, gosh, I hope that it's going to be more transparent, more user-friendly. I think, a website ends up over a number of years being a conglomeration of every individual who goes to your website seeking information and can't find what they want to find, and then we make incremental updates along the way. And we have, over 21 different departments, a very, very broad and deep array of information. But it's been about 7 or 8 years since we did a website overhaul. And one of the most interesting things is that so many people are using mobile devices now, tablets and other types of handheld devices to use the website. And so we need a new website overhaul. Our hope is it presents information more succinctly, more clearly, and provides greater transparency. And what we're hearing is we're even sort of behind the ball, that large organizations are doing this almost every 5 years, and I think we're at, I can't remember if it's 7 or 9 years, and so this is something that we've been working on for, believe it or not, about a year now. It's a very, very lengthy, detailed project where we don't want to miss any information in the transition, and we want to kind of clarify things and clean things out.
So there's a contract for $186,000 on records management software and services. Is this go hand in hand with the website?
It does, sort of. In fact, that it will be integrated and it will increase our city website's transparency. So this is another project that our staff's been working on for several years. We have a relatively new city recorder over the last couple of years working with the IT department, where we have an antiquated system of record archival when it comes to contracts and insurance forms and invoices. And so we are seeking a new 21st century technological system that will provide greater transparency to the public, and that it will be incorporated within our website. So if someone's curious about an old RFP or an old paving contract or what happened with the sidewalk in front of their house or the signed contract of the city, all of this information can be housed in one area that's sourceable to the public the same way it is for staff. So it should provide a very, very high level of transparency.
Okay. What's the latest with the Woodside Park Phase 2 appeal, that after the Board of Adjustments sided with the appellant on the project setback reductions?
No decision yet. I think as the property owner, or as sort of the developer, the city is kind of having some internal meetings and talking with some stakeholders about what we might do from here. We're not sure, quite frankly. We've got some neighbors in that area that had some concerns. And so we are sort of repositioning ourselves and trying to come up with either a 2.0 version or some other alternatives to consider. And I think the silver lining here for the community is that when we make those types of decisions, we do them publicly, and we'd be seeking public input along the way.
Right. So it seems that the city may need to redesign some elements then of Woodside too. Certainly, one of the impacts of this development is the senior center. So, I mean, are we starting to talk about maybe we could accommodate the senior center where it is and build Woodside around it, or move the senior center within Woodside Phase 2? And yeah, maybe we give up a few units, but we've also preserved the senior center.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get ahead of myself. Again, we're having some internal meetings. I'd suggest that there are a lot of things on the table right now, but I don't want to get ahead of myself. So I can't say yes or no. I think there are a lot of things on the table, and a redesign or some component of a redesign may be necessary. And then secondarily, our commitment to the seniors is strong. I don't think that that anyone's in any type of position that feels like we're going to have an outcome that the seniors won't enjoy or won't be desirable. And we've been meeting with different types of senior groups over the last several weeks. There's been new groups formed, and we're encouraged by the extra level of participation.
Finally, I wanted to mention that the council will be discussing the updated memorandum of agreement for the Flagstaff Development Historic Preservation Requirements, $1.4 million from developers and the city over 20 years. So how did we get there?
Well, good question. It's obviously, this sort of simplifies a very long and complex development agreement. And, most old development agreements in this community are sort of defamed or cast at aspersion for just getting old and antiquated and not following covenants. But the upside of these is that it does provide the opportunity to come back and revisit these issues and ensure, to the best of our ability, that covenants are adhered to. And so, for the last, I'd say 6 to almost 9 months, we've been working with the developer in that area. Several components were found out of compliance, and we've come up with a new methodology that we think preserves to a great deal the historic sites and their integrity in that area. And we know that this was very important to the community, to the Historic Preservation Board, to the Historic Society. And I think we're proud that the developers come to the table, the owners' associations come to the table, and Park City Municipals come to the table and all said, hey, no, this was important. We had some previous agreements, and we've got an obligation to honor them. And so we're proud of the resources we're bringing forward here.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
I did just one extra thing, in that we are having an annual State of the City next week on Tuesday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Santee Auditorium. It'll be the second time that the mayor and city council will be having a State of the City. And similar to last year, it'll start at 6 o'clock, and we'll have some sort of a pie social. We'll be eating pie and kind of mixing and mingling with the crowd, and we'll be recapping some of the highlights of 2019. We'll be covering some of the pillars that came out of the visioning process. Spanish translation services will be provided. But to harken back to where we started, you know, last year I think we had over 300 people in the room, not 31. So we want to get as many people there as we can. We really encourage the community to participate. It's a wonderful opportunity to learn about everything that's going on in municipal government for the year and then what lies ahead.
Okay. Are we going to be streaming that live?
We will be.
Okay. Matt, thanks.
Thanks, Leslie.
It's Park City Manager Matt Dias. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:48. On Saturday, the Park City Institutes presents National Geographic Live with Emmy Award-winning cinematographer Bob Poole. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Great, great. So why don't you start and tell us about how these National Geographic events work? You've done these before in other communities.
Yeah, really, they're quite a lot of fun. We start with a sort of pre-show loop that just explains a little bit about National Geographic and what they're up to. And then I get introduced and I start my show. It's kind of a, I guess you would say, it's more of a show than anything else. I mean, I'm going to tell a story about, well, my life and how I ended up in this amazing place called Gorongosa National Park in Mozambique and what happened to me there and what happened to the park. It's quite an uplifting story. It's called Nature Roars Back, and it really is about how resilient nature is, probably, I would say, especially in Africa.
So you'll have, what, video clips or photographs or?
Yes. So I have a combination of, it's mostly a story told with still images. However, I use video clips from my series, which was a National Geographic PBS six-part series that I was the main sort of character and narrator, presenter, I guess you would say, of the series. And it was a lot about, you know, my experiences there. So I do use clips in my show to sort of advance the story and to really set you right in the middle of the action.
So I think I read that you spent like a year in Mozambique to get to...
Well, actually, I spent a lot longer than that. I first went there, and I'll tell the story. I started working there in 2008 on a National Geographic film called Africa's Lost Eden. And I really sort of became addicted to the park. I went, just kept, you know, finding excuses to go back and film more. So I did a couple of other feature film called The Guide and a thing for BBC. And then I did another National Geographic project called War Elephants. And sort of one project after another, I kept in the park and eventually landed this series, which kept me there for another 2 years. So all in all, you know, I was there for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. So were you the only photographer then for this six-part series?
No. I mean, of course, we had a film team, a crew, people coming and going. I was there most of the time, and which I'll tell my story. I was often on my own, but definitely working together as part of a team. But very exciting. We get into a lot of, you know, the park has a very interesting history. It is a very exciting place. But I tell stories of the lions there, the elephants, and a lot of the exploration that took place.
Yeah, so talk to us just a little bit about Gorongosa National Park, because it, like you say, it kind of went through a rebirth.
Yes, it did, actually. You know, it had been one of Africa's greatest national parks. And a long war for independence broke out against Portugal in 1964, followed by an even longer war, civil war that lasted until 1992. If you can imagine that, a million people were killed in the country, and the soldiers from both sides of the battles fed themselves off the park's wildlife. In fact, the resistance, Renamo, based themselves on Mount Gorongosa, and you know they killed the elephants there to trade their ivory for guns and ammunition, and they really devastated the park. But an American philanthropist, actually, from happens to live in Idaho, went there back, almost 20 years ago now, and created a public-private partnership with the Mozambican government to start to restore the park. And when I arrived, he had just gotten started on that. It was probably maybe 4 years into it. And so the park was really, I mean, we didn't see much wildlife in those days. But what happened during the time that I was there was just unbelievable. It's just, it's so hard to describe. But in my story, I do my best to explain just how incredible it was to see the wildlife start to come back. And where it was then and where it is now is, of course, just absolutely staggering. So it's a great story of hope and how natural systems can recover if we give them a chance.
So what would we find then at that park? I mean, the Africa's Big Five?
Well, yeah, I mean, pretty much. You would probably see lions. You would see lots and lots of big antelopes nowadays, elephants, hippos. The last count, they had over 100,000 big animals in the park, whereas when I first started going there, we didn't see many animals at all. So tremendous recovery. Now, not all animals recover at the same speed. You know, elephants, of course, live long lives. It takes a long time for them to recover. But they are settling down, and there are lots and lots of babies in the park. We've now seen leopards coming in back on their own. There's been hyenas spotted again. So these are really good things. And recently, they've started releasing wild dogs into the ecosystem, which is great because wild dogs are endangered. You know, they're very threatened, and they're running out of habitat. And so Gorongosa is great wild dog habitat, and there's now two packs of wild dogs that are seen regularly in the park.
Wow. So your sister, Joyce Poole, a renowned elephant researcher, did she work on this with you as part of
it? Yes. Joyce and I worked on another project for National Geographic in Gorongosa about the elephants there. And then Joyce came back and joined me for this series. And so anything that we were doing with elephants included Joyce. And we had a lot of good stories to tell there.
Yeah. Well, it's you and she, it sounds like you grew up in Africa, at least spent part of your childhood there, huh?
Yes. Well, my parents, my father was a Peace Corps director, and he moved to Africa when I was 3 years old. So my first memories are in Africa. We grew up there throughout the 60s and 70s, you know, as I was a child and through high school. And then I went back. My older sister got studying elephants, made remarkable discoveries about elephants when she was in her early 20s. Actually, my first film for National Geographic was about her and her work. So we've been working together for a long time. Ever since then, you know, most of my work has been in Africa, all over the continent. But we really do spend a lot of time still in Eastern Africa.
Yeah. And spending so much time photographing wildlife, is there a particular animal? I mean, is there a favorite? I know that's kind of like asking what your favorite kid is, but
well, I love all animals and I love wildlife of all kinds, but you know, I definitely love elephants. I mean, elephants are so interesting. They're so much like ourselves. They're intelligent and they have close family bonds and they're just interesting on so many levels. And so I feel like elephants are one of my favorites, but I also love, you know, I love spending time with lions. And I think in this story, we're going to tell some really fun stories about lions as well. So lions and elephants are up there.
Yeah. So how do you think productions or presentations like this help with wildlife conservation?
Well, you know, I mean, it's not television, it's not a magazine article. It's live, and I think it's nice to be able to sort of take an hour or a little longer and really absorb into one thing like that, uninterrupted, no commercials, no, and then you get to witness a story live, and then ask me questions. So, you know, if anything strikes you as interesting there, you want to know more about, I'm up there on stage fielding questions, and then I actually go out out in front of the auditorium and in the lobby and field questions there as well until people are done.
Okay. Well, again, Bob Poole and the National Geographic Nature Roars Back will be at the Park City Eccles Center February 29th. That's this Saturday, 7:30 p.m. Tickets start at just $29. People can get more information at parkcityinstitute.org. We appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.